Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there, this is Fran Lewis, and guess what? It's not snowing, it's not raining, it's about 60 degrees outside, and it's so cool because I don't need a jacket, and it's absolutely gorgeous, and we're going to have a really, really great show today. I am totally, totally excited that we have author David Morrell, and he's best known for his debut novel. I'm reading it straight from the back cover of his book that we're going to talk about, First Blood. And actually, my brother, who does not know half of the people I've interviewed, got all excited and said, oh, my God, for the first time. He introduced the character of Rambo, and we're going to talk about a book that's really quite unique in its own right, and it's right here. It's called Murder as a Fine Art. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, and I'm glad that you're able to get out and about without the weather dumping on you.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Yeah, any day that I could get up at like 6:15, 6:30, take a walk to the bakery and tell the guy, "Where's my oatmeal?" I'm a happy girl. like I said, I don't cook. I would ruin it if I had to make it myself. That would really be bad.
Do you have a Trader Joe's where you are?
Yes, and they have a really good...
They
have what?
They have an oatmeal. You mentioned oatmeal. They make, my wife calls them hockey pucks. They make frozen packets of oatmeal, steel-cut oatmeal, and two per package, and I practically live off the things every morning.
I didn't know that they did that. I know that they make them in cans. And my husband attempts to pour, you know, it into a measuring cup and says, all you need to do is put the right amount of water. I said, well, if you don't pour the water in the glass in the refrigerator, it's not going to get done the right way. Forget it.
That's right. You're right.
So I don't do it. Yeah. And since I only eat oatmeal with nothing in it, my diet is really not that great. The guy in Enrico's down the block from my house, I love them. I just called Jimmy in the morning about 6:30. I said, make me three, and that's all it takes to do it. It's great. So,
and then you walk down.
I like to walk in the morning. It's a lot of fun. It keeps me, I'm thin, but it keeps me in shape, so it's even better. And I don't drink their coffee. I just have their oatmeal and their delicious rolls. The kind that have nothing that tastes good.
I don't eat rolls. I gave up on wheat, but I exercise every day. My writing schedule is such that I start around 8:30, and in the middle of the day before lunch, I exercise for an hour, and then after that, I can get back to work. So it's really important if you do a lot of sitting.
Well, I can't sit still, which is really amazing. I really can't sit still. And if I don't get up, even after an hour of reading or trying to get a review done or trying to focus, sometimes it's hard to focus on some stuff, I have to go out and just take a walk. It's just great just to walk around the block and just get some fresh air.
Yep.
I literally have 50 books inside that are staring at me and praying that I actually get it. It just seems that the postman brings like 6 or 7 a day. It's like, oh, my God, books have every type, everything. And I don't know about you, but there are certain ones that I won't read and certain ones that move to the top of the list. The ones that move to the top of the list are the ones with the least amount of pages and the largest print. No, seriously.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, well, I have to tell you, when I received your book, Murder as Fine Art, it's because Mark Rubenstein read it, and he said he did an interview, but he said, you might want to read it. So I was so excited that you sent it to me that no sooner did I get the book here did my husband say to me, you better get that done fast because it's mine next. He literally, he doesn't read anything. It takes him like a week and a half, 2 weeks to read something. He picked this up and he couldn't put it down. He read it in a day, which is like, oh, my God, I can't believe that. And he actually asked me to buy. I bought the Quincy book, Open Eater. I haven't had a chance to read it because there are so many other books I have to read in between. But I'm going to get to it.
Is it the biography of Thomas De Quincey or the collection of his work about opium?
I think it's the biography. I'm not sure whichever one is on Amazon.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of them on Amazon. One of the things, you know, I guess we should explain that. I had I've been writing for 42 years, which is an eternity in the publishing world, because most careers end after 20 years. The reason for that is that authors tend to find something early that works for them, and they repeat it and repeat it.
Mm.
There are exceptions, but it's familiar enough syndrome, and we've all seen it, where you reach a point where you say, you know, I get the idea, I'm not going to read this person anymore. And coincidentally, usually about that time, the author gets tired, too, from doing the same book for 20 years. But I had something happened to me, and in 2009 I became fascinated with the Victorian era, and here I am, known for contemporary American subjects, and as you mentioned, I created Rambo in my first novel, First Blood, which is different from the movie. I decided to go back to Victorian England, and 1854 London, to be precise, and spent 2 years doing nothing but reading about 1854 London. It was quite a journey.
It was. I learned an awful lot just reading it. And what made you decide that? What made you decide to include him?
Well, it's part of the story is personal. My granddaughter Natalie died in 2009 from a rare bone cancer called Ewing's sarcoma. And this is the same bone cancer that killed my son in 1987.
Oh, wow.
And very, very few people get the disease. There are only about 200 people that get it each year. And I was absolutely devastated, as you might expect, because it was, you know, I've done this road twice. And my daughter was even more, you know, because, I mean, I had a grim joke that I said, well, I've had practice, you know, but my daughter had not had the practice. And she fixated on movies and books that were about grief. And the movie she fixated on at that time in 2009 was a movie called Creation, which is about Charles Darwin's nervous breakdown when he was writing on The Origin of Species. What had happened is that his favorite daughter had died. And his wife, who was a devout Christian, believed that The Origin of Species was going to threaten people's faith. And they got to thinking that maybe God had killed the child to stop him from writing the book. Which is, my heavens, the anguish and the emotions. So he had a nervous breakdown, and the breakdown wasn't something that anybody would understand in the mid-1850s, before Freud. And there was a moment near the end of the film where a messenger kind of character shows up and says, you know, Charles, there are people like Thomas De Quincey who are saying that we can be controlled by thoughts and emotions that we don't know we have. And that sure sounded like Freud. But Freud published 40 years later, and I got very excited. I said, this can't be true, because I'd read Thomas De Quincey, you know, in college, because he was known as the first guy who wrote about drug addiction in a book called Confessions of an English Opium Eater. And so I think I was ready to escape, that I was just tired of the world and, you know, grief and everything. And I retreated to Victorian London and began doing a lot of research about Thomas De Quincey. And the more I learned about him, the more interesting he became, that he invented the word subconscious. He did anticipate Freud actually by 70 years. And, in fact, we know Freud before Freud was Freud. We know that Freud read De Quincey in Baudelaire's French translation of De Quincey. So there's a strong reason to believe that Freud maybe, you know, was heavily influenced. So, and De Quincey was fascinated with a real life mass murder that occurred in 1811 called the Radcliffe Highway Murders, which is what the book's about. We'll not get to it, but just to round off this topic, when De Quincey was fascinated by these murders, wrote about them in an essay called On Murder, Considered as One of the Fine Arts. He invented the true crime genre, and he influenced Edgar Allan Poe heavily, and Poe went on to influence Sir Arthur Conan Doyle to create Sherlock Holmes. And, I mean, there was just a lot to be impressed by. And one day I had this idea, hey, I'm going to write a Victorian mystery thriller in which, Lord help me, Thomas De Quincey, is the main character, and I never look back.
It was so interesting from the minute I opened the first page of the book. And what made you decide, I mean, I know Mark told me that you're a sensory writer and that you use the five senses within your novels,
yes.
Right? See, I
yes.
got that. I remember. And yeah, which is true, because I'm looking at the first chapter, and the artist of death, as he's getting dressed, you could picture him. I felt like I was going on the journey to kill the person with him.
And the first paragraph is also a summary. It's a paraphrase of a passage from De Quincey's essay about murder as a fine art. So there are a lot of in stuff. You know, if people who know De Quincey are, you know, inclined to toward that kind of, they can sort of feel that there's a lot of De Quincey between the lines. Yeah, the thing about description. When I teach writing a lot around the country at writers' conferences, and you know, the most common mistake that writers make, prose writers, fiction writers, is that they tend to emphasize only one sight and only one sense, and usually that's the sense of sight. And you know, there's a kind of you can get a relationship there that a one-dimensional book, a thin book, so to speak. Is one that has only the sense of sight in it, and that multidimensional books have that feeling because the author has used as many senses as possible. And in any given scene, I try to use three to kind of. Years ago, when I was in grad school, I did my doctoral dissertation on John Barth, and John Barth had a theory about triangulation in description, that if you used you used three of the five senses in any scene, that you would get that, you know, that sense of multiplicity that we're talking about. And so that's, you know, I think one reason why maybe the book works for people is I had a note at the side of my desk that said, try to make people believe they are truly in 1854 London. And I, you know, with all the research I did as to what it was like back then, and then using the multiple senses in order to draw, hypnotize, as it were, people into that world, I guess I succeeded, because an awful lot of people have gotten in touch with me saying that they really felt they were there.
I certainly felt like I was reliving the murder scene myself. I felt like from the moment I opened the book and started to the artist of death, and as he prepared himself and as he goes through the first murder, I said, oh my God, I felt my heart palpitations. And I said, oh, this is great.
Scene. You may recall in the I wrote a little foreword about what were called sensation novels of the Victorian period. People like Wilkie Collins and Mary Elizabeth Braddon, whom I've become a big fan of, the writing sensation novels, which is another word for thrillers. And but you know, at the end of that introduction, I made a note to the reader. I said, in effect, look, I know this first chapter, this first section is tough. This is going to make your heart pound. It's a recreation of the original Ratcliffe Highway murders. So you read this and you'll see why everybody was so appalled. So I tried to warn people, you know, and then I had to laugh on Amazon. You wonder how about the people, some people at least, who post reviews on Amazon, because one person came on and said, I absolutely hate this book. There's too much murder in it. And I thought, well, you know, the title ought to have given you a clue as to what the heck the book was about. You know, why are you complaining? Why are you surprised? It astonishes me sometimes how people react.
Well, a lot of the book reviewers, and not me, on Amazon, I don't read the book reviews until I post mine. And then I might check around and see what other people, most of the time people don't read the book. A lot of people just say, oh, this is a wonderful book, and my Aunt Bertha told me it was great, so I think you should read it. Well, I didn't quite, I had a review for one of my books, and everybody gave it like 4 stars, 5 stars, whatever, and this girl said, I couldn't understand what you wrote, so I didn't read the whole book, so I can't tell you what I really thought, and she gave it 2 stars, and I just said, it's a pity that you can't finish what you start. Usually I just ignore comments. I don't really care.
De Quincey had a line for that. De Quincey once went up to somebody and said, "Sir, I admired your book so much that I almost finished it."
I mean, seriously. I mean, half of these people don't read the book. The other half
One guy gave me one star. He said, "I bought this book. I started to read it, and then I realized that I'd already read it. So I'm giving it one star."
Oh, that's just absolutely. You know, Amazon will take that off, but you don't care. I mean,
I called Amazon,
and I had somebody wrote something on one of my books, and I said, you know what? They didn't read the book. This was a nasty, derogatory, whatever. They did take it off. They took the review off because they said that the person was really, you know, not too bright. A lot of reviewers just don't read. There's one or two that actually, if you look at the back cover of some books and you look at some book reviews, some people actually reword the back cover.
I don't know what the mechanism is, but, you know, as I said, I just thought that was hilarious that somebody says there's too much murder in this. Why would you pick up a book called Murder is a Fine Art if you don't?
Maybe he thought it was about an artist that was creating a painting about murder.
It could be. It could be. I don't know. It eludes me.
You know what? People, just like I said, a lot of people don't know what a book review really is. Half of them are just comments. They're not reviews.
When I was in grad school, you know, what I was taught was, try to figure out what the book's trying to be.
Yeah.
And then review the book on the basis of what seems to have been the intent. Now, you know, granted, we can't always know what an author intended us for us to do. But for the most part, we know, for example, Murder is a Fine Art is a mystery thriller. So we judge it on the basis of how well it conforms to our expectations of a mystery thriller, not going at a mystery thriller and says, well, it's a mystery thriller, therefore I'll give it one star. I mean,
I know. Well, I usually, so far, I have to tell you, I've done almost close to 2,500 books. I don't even know. Seriously, that's what I've been counting. And I've been told by most authors, you usually get what we're trying to say. I try to look to see if there's a message in there besides just, you know, I don't want to just give a summary. I want to figure out what is the author trying to say? What is the issue that's coming through that maybe no one else is going to get? And I usually get it. But it takes a while. You have to go, you know, long and hard to do. It may not take me that long to read a book because if I speed read it, which I do, then I go back over it. It could take me like 2 hours to read 400 pages if my eyes don't bug out. I'm pretty fast.
Yeah.
But then to do the review, believe it or not, it's going to take longer because I want to do it right. And then I'll read it over and pray that I can't read on my computer. My eyes start to burn. So sometimes I'll just say to myself, okay, you better read it over later. Make sure that you didn't spell any words wrong and have any typos. Not intentional, but I really can't read on my computer. And this morning my nephew texted me last night at 8 o'clock. We have an essay we have to work on, and this is a topic. Did you read this book? I go, no. He says, well, download it because you're going to read it now. I go, no, I'm not. I said, I'm going to wait till Amazon brings me my copy today, which I overnighted it, and then I'm going to read it. But I was able to figure out which. I remembered reading it a long time ago, the Boy in the Striped Pajamas. That was really sad. So I was helping him do that about 3 o'clock this morning. And I said, that's what ants do. They help with homework, what can I say? So you created this first scene that gave everybody heart palpitations so that no one could catch their breath and that final blow. But De Quincey is very interesting. I actually have to tell you, when people do research about the FBI, about Scotland Yard, about crime scenes, I actually looked up the Radcliffe murders. And I wanted to make sure, I do this all the time, to make sure that I get what the author's saying, even though you explained it and talked about it. So could you tell listeners about the Radcliffe murders?
I'd love to. They happened in December of 1811 in the east end of London, which in those days was a terrible place. It was the dock side of London, and for anybody who's curious, the Tower of London represents a demarcation between the east and the west parts of London, mm-hmm. and to the east were the docks, and it was just a bad place. And in those days, people worked 6 days a week, and mm-hmm. they tended to be paid late on a Saturday, and that was their time to go out and buy things. So stores remained open until midnight. And in this particular case, a linen merchant, he sold socks and, shirts and things of that nature. It was midnight, and he was getting ready to close. He had a wife. He had a, I'm going to say, five-month-old child. I'd have to go back. It might have been six. It's been a while since I looked at the number. And he had a shop boy and a shop girl, and he sent the girl out at midnight to pay a baker's bill and to buy oysters for supper. Now, this might sound luxurious, but in those days, oysters were a cheap commodity, and they were prized because you didn't need to cook them. And, like, there weren't stoves. A lot of places didn't have stoves, and they'd be cooking over a fireplace. So this was a good thing. So she went out. She couldn't find it. The baker was closed. The oyster place was closed. Came back. And the door was locked. And so she pounded on the door. She couldn't get in. She's getting scared. It's well after midnight now. And a night watchman, there were no police officers at that time, came along. And then a neighbor came out and said, "What's all the noise?" And finally he said, "Oh, all right, I'll go in and go in through over the fence in the back, and I'll see if the back door's open." So he did that. He opened the door, and everybody was dead. They had all been murdered by a ship carpenter's maul or a hammer. And their skulls have been drove in, including the infant's. This is what made it so horrific. The infant's skull was, and then he had slit all of their throats, including the infant's. And then he had taken them all, and the child was in a crib, a wicker crib, and he smashed the heck out of the crib and piled the remnants of wicker on top of the baby. And this... there were no doubt mass murders before this time, but they hadn't been publicized. The reading rate was low, the travel, you know, there wasn't a mail system, et cetera. And now there were improved roads, and there were these mail coaches that traveled all the way across England at what was then a very fast 10 miles an hour. They considered that rapid. And all the news with, and there were 52 newspapers in London, and the news of this killing, mass killing, just shot all the way through England and into Scotland and over to Ireland, and paralyzed the nation, because it had never, this kind of atrocity had never been publicized before, and the nation shut down, and 11 days later it happened again. 12 days later, and the consternation was huge. And at this time, it was a tavern in which the owner of the tavern, his wife, and their servant, their female servant, was killed. Same way, head beat in, throat slit. London and all of England was paralyzed. It's a little like what happened at the end of the century. This was the beginning of the century. At the end of the century, Jack the Ripper did. But this is, 80 years earlier. And it's impossible to describe the psychological effect on England. And De Quincey was fascinated by it. He collected every scrap of information he could about the murders, and in 1854, years afterward, published an essay, I call them 50 blood-soaked pages, in which he recreated the murders step by step, using sophisticated cross-cutting between the victims and the murderer in a way that almost reminds us of an Alfred Hitchcock movie. and in the process, he invented the true crime genre as we understand it. So the plot for the book, basically, one day I had this notion, what if the essay was published with a collection of his works, and what if he were De Quincey had lived in London, in Scotland, but what if he came back to London to publicize his collected works, and what if while he was in London, in 1854, at the same time many years earlier that the original murders had occurred,
mm-hmm.
what if they started to happen again and it was clear that the killer was using De Quincey's essay as a blueprint? And that naturally he would be the suspect because we know he's obsessed with the murders and he's an opium addict. So with that thought, you know, I said to myself, I think I have the makings for a book here.
Yeah, you did, because just like police officers today, I guess, it just was sort of like he just fit the bill for the person to be accused of the crime, and they didn't
yes.
go and they didn't go any further. The fact that he
yes,
was so
addicted,
yeah, he was addicted to opium, right? And he would
yes.
take walks at night. And I see, I got this memorized here. I read this
yes.
like last month, and I'm saying this is one of, you know, I read a lot of books, and if you read them, and I remember them, and I do the review, and then you forget. You can't forget this one. It stays in your brain. And I could picture the scenes in my head and going like, oh my God, this is worse than Jack the Ripper. This is like more, you know, graphic.
Well, it was more, you know, for the historical period, it was more
yeah.
shocking, but. You know, you mentioned
yeah.
opium. Let's talk a little bit
yeah.
about it. In the
yeah.
1800s, opium was available in a pill form, or else it was available in the form of what was called laudanum, L-A-U-D-A-N-U-M.
Yep.
And this was a mixture of powdered opium and drinking alcohol, usually brandy. And we find it astonishing that this was legally and cheaply available just about everywhere. You could get it. You could get opium and laudanum from the grocer, from the butcher. You could get it, it is said, from the paperboy. I have a bottle. It took me a long time to track down a bottle. Not laudanum in it. But I have an empty bottle of it. It cost me, it took me a while. It cost me $300 to get this bottle. But I use it a lot in the public demonstrations, so it was worth the cost. But it's clearly on the label. There's a skull and crossbones, and it says poison. And then, I mean, it was the only effective painkiller available. And people sometimes confused getting rid of the pain with cure. So they used it for back pain, for cancer, for colds. They even use it for baby colic, and on the label, there's a recommended 3 drops in a glass of water for infants. I love that, and up to 20 drops for adults.
He drank a whole bottle. He would drink the whole flask, wouldn't he?
These usually came in 1 ounce containers, and what you did is you use drops from it. A tablespoon might kill you if you drank the whole ounce bottle. It would kill you if you were used to it. And he was drinking 16 ounces of it a day. By his own count, he was drinking on a good day 1,000 drops of it. And 20 drops was the normal recommended dosage with the poison label on it. And now here's the miracle. He lived like this for 50 years. He became an addict in his mid-20s. And he had a toothache, and he started taking it, and, you know, it got more and more and more until finally he was an addict. But when I was writing the book, and, you know, I'm thinking, here I have this Victorian mystery thriller in which my main character is an opium addict. And, you know, I'm thinking, this is heavy stuff, because the tendency is to say, well, you know, this is going to be this whacked out guy and who'd want to read about him. But the truth was, and I've very well read, because I was a professor, and most people who use drugs and wrote, we think of the Beat Generation, for example, it was pretty undisciplined, kind of sloppy stuff for the most part. I admire the Beats. For a lot of things, but it's difficult to find, you know, maybe On the Road is pretty coherent, but a lot of it isn't. And or if you look at Coleridge, who was an opium addict, you know, very indulgent, didn't have much of a career, and sometimes this stuff is a little, you know, floaty, for lack of a better word. And so I'm thinking, you know, how could Thomas De Quincey have written thousands and thousands of pages, and for the most part have done acquitted himself in a sequel to Murder is a Fine Art that'll come out next year. I wrote a passage.
Oh, I was wondering about that. That was one of my questions, by the way, if you're going to write another one.
Oh, well, just anticipate. Yeah, the demand was so huge.
Oh, good.
The people wanted a second one. It's called Inspector of the Dead, and it'll come out early next year. But in that book, Emily De Quincey, who figures prominently in the first one as well, says, I don't know if opium makes him a better writer or if he'd be a better writer if he wasn't taking the opium, but all I know is that what he does is something that nobody else can do. And, you know, that was my feeling, that this guy had access. You know, what he believed, the way it worked was that the opium caused these massive nightmares for him, and then he called, you know, these epical nightmares. Mm-hmm. He said that the entire history of the world passed before him in his sleep. And when he woke up thinking about what opium had done to him in his dreams, and there's a lot of Freudian stuff in that, he began to theorize. That's when he invented the word subconscious, and that we had chambers in our mind, chasms and sunless abysses, he called it, and that it was possible within each person to have an alien nature hidden without us being aware of it. I mean, he's talking about schizophrenia, essentially. And so I got, you know, something about the opium moved him into a way of thinking that was preternatural, perhaps, is a good word. So, and the trick was, how do I write about an opium addict who was notorious? He was known as the opium eater all his life. How do I write about him and make him sympathetic? And the answer was, he had a 21-year-old daughter named Emily, who was a really interesting woman. And I put many of the sections in the book from her point of view toward him, so that if we were willing to accept her and like her, therefore, because she liked him, we would like him. And so it was a tactical, you know, if once I figured out to do that, then I thought, all right, the book's going to work, because originally I had grave doubts about the book because, you know, how was I going to handle this guy? I mean, in a way, he's a genius, and I don't do drugs, and how am I going to get into this guy's head? Well, I didn't need to, because all I needed to do is look at him from his daughter's point of view. And because she had such a unique personality, she won us over, and therefore we were willing to like him. So that was the tactic, and you know, it's because of Emily De Quincey, the 21-year-old, that I think the book works. She's the secret to the book.
Yes, she was in her journal, which I won't tell anybody was written. What was it? Yeah, the journal really made it clarified exactly who she was, so that if people have difficulty following, which they shouldn't, then they would understand him better, you know, through her words.
Exactly.
But,
got it
which
exactly
leads,
so.
I'm trying. You see, I got it. Emily was really a trip and a half, and the police back then were quite different.
Yes.
The technology that came out was different. How did they, first of all, I was flabbergasted when the police constable and inspector didn't get the respect that they deserved when the public was, you know, yelling to lynch somebody. And then he leaves this poor guy with a lantern, and he gets bopped, and then he has to not get the fingerprints. I remembered. And then he has to make sure that they could get the shoe print that's down there. This poor guy, I felt so, so bad. And he thought he was going to get fired because he thought maybe he tainted it. So what kind of technology did they have back then in order to solve the case? And basically, this guy was so clever, there were no fingerprints or anything.
Well, there wouldn't have been. They didn't know about fingerprints, so that wouldn't have mattered. But this is the deal. There was a French criminal named François Lidocq, and we're talking France now, Paris, And he had been in trouble early years of the 1800s, and he'd been in trouble with the law enough that he decided maybe what he would do is turn over and become a police officer, or at least an informant to the police, and that he would teach them the ways of criminals. And so he was now earning a living as a guy teaching the police. And his theories were part of the French police department. And now, in 1829, the British Police Department was formed. I'm saying that wrong. The Metropolitan Police in London were formed, and the first organized police force in England. And they used a lot of theories that the French were using. And now time passes, and in 1842, the Scotland Yard, as it was called, because the French the police headquarters were on that street known as Scotland Yard, they decided to implement a plainclothes detective division. And now there were a couple of reasons for this. One was that the police, the uniform police, were all organized into districts. And it was difficult for one district to communicate with another district except through headquarters. And it was thought that the plainclothes police, there were two inspectors and five sergeants, and that they would be able to fan out everywhere and collect information and do it invisibly. And maybe this would help, you know, the efficient way of combating crime. So anyway, what happened was that the Scotland Yard Detective Division went over to Paris and studied with Ledoq. And by then he was a private investigator. He was the first publicized private investigator. And so he taught them about the ways of criminals and ways of looking for clues that criminals leave, that, you know, if you're a lock picker, you're going to leave certain evidence, and if you do this and that. And also about the same time, people got the idea about footprints and using plaster of Paris to make impressions of the footprints, the boot prints. And so they didn't have a lot of criminal tools, but what they had was a brand new idea, first of all, of a police force that would be used to prevent crime, and you know, a totally new idea. And secondly, I go into this more in the sequel, the two guys that started Scotland Yard, one was somebody who'd been in the military, and he organized the Scotland Yard on the basis of a kind of a military unit with the uniforms and the, you know, the various, you know, sergeants and all of that. The second guy was a barrister and a lawyer. And he had been used to presenting evidence in court and was used to the idea that you couldn't just go on and say in court and say, this guy did it. You had to have the evidence. So he was constantly telling the police officers, the constables, look, you know, you can't just grab some guy. We need you to find ways to prove that the guy did it. So evidence became the big deal, and this was a revolutionary concept that had not existed a century earlier. So it is the detectives, the two detectives that I use in the novel, who are using these new, very brand new ways of handling crime, of actually investigating and asking questions and picking up things that, you know, might be useful later. Scotland Yard was one of the first police departments to, if somebody was arrested, they wrote down the description and whether they were left or right-handed and whether they had birthmarks and or a lisp or any of that stuff. But prior to that, when people were arrested, they just went to jail. So now we had a card catalog system. And, you know, you put it all together, and it was pretty revolutionary. And writing about that early period, you know, is exciting because you can see them trying to work out how the heck to be police officers.
I'm wondering if they were more accurate back then than they are back now. Of course, they have all their computers and they have all their technology and stuff, and I know that they could find out. But maybe they were more methodical back then because they didn't have all
things. They had to be, you know, they had to, you know, to really study, you know, and ask questions. They loved asking questions, and they'd send people out, you know, canvassing whole neighborhoods, just talking to everybody. Did you hear a scream last night? Did you see somebody that was unusual?
Mm-hmm.
But you said something interesting earlier that, I mean, you said many interesting things, but there's something that seized on me. You said that they didn't get respect, and the reason for that is that England, particularly then, and even so now, is a stratified society, the lower class, the middle class, and the upper class. And the police officers were employees. They were considered laborers. So that if you had, a situation where the policeman would talk to a middle class, or God forbid, a upper class person, that person was crossing societal lines and being an affront. So the police officer had to be very polite, and also there was that whole issue that it was believed that good breeding and education were an antidote to vice, so that no middle class or upper class person could commit a murder or be a thief. It was just unthinkable, but of course they did. But, you know, the popular imagination was that it was impossible. So you had this whole issue of police officers trying to investigate crimes while the half, you know, a majority of the people they were speaking to were suspicious, saying, hey, man, you're just an employee. Why don't you, you know, go bother somebody else?
Well, what was the hierarchy? There was a police commissioner. There was somebody in charge, right?
Yes.
At the
there
top.
There were two commissioners. There were two commissioners. And the one fellow by the time my story begins was ill. And so I just ignore him. And I emphasize a man named Commissioner Main, who stayed in the job for well over a quarter century. He was there for a very long time. And then the hierarchy would go down through the, you know, the various levels from officers. And then within the detective, as I said, there were only seven of them. There were two inspectors and five sergeants, and it stayed that way for a very long time. And then above them, if you're interested, there was the Home Secretary, who was part of the cabinet for the Prime Minister, and the Home Secretary was in charge of the police and national security and everything else that happened in a combination of, in our country, half a dozen agencies that we have, that, you know, it'd be like the running the CIA and the FBI and God knows what all else, and the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Home Defense. I mean, this guy handled everything that happened in the country. Excuse me. And his name was Lord Palmerston, and he's a fascinating person in his own right, and he has a strong element in the story, too. You know, as I said, I just tried to make people feel, you know, if they picked up a newspaper from that period, they'd understand what was going on by reading the novel.
Well, there are a lot of, you know, even today, cross agencies and agencies that are supposed to work together, and you begin to wonder if they really do work together or
if they
work again. Yeah, if they do. But I think Emily was really quite remarkable. As she got, when the police tried to tell her, they wanted to arrest her father, and how she convinced them to do it when she wanted to. Well, one of them was sort of taken with her. But I cracked up. I said to her, she's a perfect candidate for Women's Lib. And she took,
before Women's Lib.
No holes barred, lady. The jail scene.
The jail scene.
The jail scene was remarkable. Why did the guards, they were afraid of her.
Yeah, well, because they're not used to women asking questions. And, you know, she's very funny, and she has this way of asking questions that, you know, people in authority, the governor, what we call the warden, the governor of the prison and she's saying, you know, asking these questions, these seemingly innocent questions, but the more he answers, the more he trips over himself because he begins to realize that what he's saying is nonsense. He just, you know, and also the revelations is one of the things that I found fascinating was that at that time, in prison cells, there was a wooden box attached to the wall with a crank on it, mm-hmm. a handle, and it was a sealed box, and in it was sand and a cup mm-hmm. that was attached to the crank. And a prisoner was required to keep turning that crank in order to move the cup inside the wooden box, lifting and dumping sand. And as Emily says, well, you know, why are you requiring them to do this? And the governor, the warden, says, well, you know, we don't want them to be idle. And she says, well, don't you think it would be useful then, if you don't want them to be idle, to teach them how to be tailors or something that would allow them to earn a living mm-hmm. after they're released? And the governor, the warden, looks at her like, you know, are you insane? You know, why would we want to teach prisoners how to be useful? And, you know, if we, with a modern mentality, looking at this, you know, mm-hmm. in some ways it's both humorous and appalling, because this is the way that these prisons operated. And you know, we just sort of say to ourselves, there's got to be a better way. And Emily, with her seemingly innocent questions, is able to expose all this. She's, you know, she, as I said earlier, she is the backbone of the novel. And when she starts to talk, she just takes over the book.
Yeah, she really does. And you realize that, I'd realized early on that basically they didn't want any of these prisoners to reform. They wanted them to come back. Because that,
well,
even I don't think they really cared about them as people. They thought
they didn't
like
care
subhuman.
At all. It was keeping people off the streets. If you were a criminal, okay, yeah, mm-hmm. and either that or they'd send you to Australia or someplace like that. And mm-hmm. the idea of rehabilitation, because you know the whole idea mm-hmm. was, you know, poverty is sinful, and I mean it's in some ways the, you know, attitudes that some mm-hmm. politicians have today, that if you're poor you're inferior and even
yeah.
sinful, and you know, I don't get this. And but the in certainly in Victorian England, good breeding, education, you know, this is what mattered. And you know, they needed the poor for, you know, certain functions, but you know, they didn't exist.
Well, people today are the same way in some cases. They judge you by your education, how much money you have, and to me that really doesn't matter. I just love when people say, you know, you're worth your bank account when you're probably worth a lot more as a person. It's scary, because I was doing an interview last year, and I'm not going to say who, and we were talking, and all of a sudden I did say to the person, I taught for a lot of years in the New York City public school system. I was a reading and writing staff developer and dean, and had my mom not been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I probably would have been the principal, hopefully a superintendent of schools, but I had to retire early. And they went, oh. I said, I'm not just a book reviewer. You know, I'm somebody else. I do have another career. Of course, now I do my magazine and everything, because I didn't want to become a couch potato, which is what was happening, a huge couch potato. Now I'm a little person. But, you know, they don't realize it. They don't. People need to judge you as a person, not for how much money you have or what social class. I really can't stand that. To me, you know, everybody's the same, and that's just the way it is. So Thomas De Quincey was really – I love the character. And you said, what do we have, about 8 more minutes? Oh, goody. Emily really, you know, made her mark, like you said, in this particular book. But the criminal was hiding in plain sight. That's
we
I
have to
say
be
who
careful
we,
here, but
I'm not going to say who
the,
it was. They'll never get it. They'll never get it.
Thing,
I won't tell you if I did, but they'll never get it.
Well. We worry. the thing about the villain, and I've done the same in the sequel, is I got De Quincey had written an essay about Macbeth. It's a very influential essay called "On the Knocking at the Gate in Macbeth," and he called it, and it is, he called it an experiment in psychological criticism. Because he wanted to analyze the viewer's emotions at a moment. Macbeth has killed the king, and the play becomes very silent. as he broods about the significance of what he's done. And in that silence, there's this sudden knocking at the gate. Someone has arrived, and we don't know who, but all of a sudden the world rushes back in. And De Quincey was fascinated by that moment. I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
Oh, okay. And in analyzing Macbeth, you know, he talked about great villains, you know. In some ways we think of Macbeth as the hero in an odd way of that play, but of course the villain, he's a murderer, he kills the king. De Quincey really emphasized the necessity for a villain to be perhaps more multidimensional than the protagonist. And I took that to heart. I thought this was an obligation. If I'm kind of, you know, an editor said that I'd become a ventriloquist for De Quincey. And I almost feel like there's a reincarnation at work here. And I thought, all right, you know, if I'm going to be true to this guy, I have to figure out how to do the villain so that he's more interesting than anybody. So that was, you know, my approach. And you know, for great passion and great grievance and an epical backstory, the same as De Quincey has an epical backstory, almost, you know, to make the villain worthy of De Quincey, or De Quincey worthy of the villain, however we want to look at it. So, you know, I was really, really pleased with the villain and the climax, you know, involving all his emotions that come roaring out, a lifetime of emotion that, you know, he's never been able to adjust to, and finally, you know, it attempts to do.
Well, it just really makes me happy to know that you're bringing them back. And I hope you bring back, the inspectors and all of them.
They're all back, including Queen Victoria.
We're going
to bring Queen Victoria forward. It's an ensemble group between Lord Palmerston and the two detectives and Commissioner Maine, and of course De Quincey and his daughter. And you know, it's interesting to me. I gained new readers with this book, and you know, people got in touch that had never read my stuff before. I don't know if it's because they like Victorian or history or what have you. And anyhow, many of them were saying, "Oh, I can't wait for Becker and Ryan to be back," and the inspector and the sergeant. And I'm thinking, this is interesting because I'm from my point of view, they're sort of supporting characters, and that De Quincey and Emily are the main attraction. But for them, you know, it's the two detectives. And I thought, isn't it interesting how, you know, readers, because of, you know, their background and their interests, will focus on elements in a book that, you know, others might not. And certainly there were an awful lot of people that wanted to know more about Becker and Ryan and their relationship with Emily. So I think that's
why they want them to come back to see where you're going to take it and what happens next. Yeah. But one last question. This is going to be an odd one, okay? Before I forget, next Thursday, be ready. The collector of dying breaths and the one and only MJ Rose will be there to discuss it. Oh,
yes.
That was another one of those books that my husband grabbed out of my hand and won't give back. And the week after, this is the first, going to interview an ophthalmologist, Dr. Frank Weinstock. I'm thinking about you and your vision, and I'm going to save your life. It's probably the best self-help book I've ever read because he tells us about healthcare, medical care, which, you know, can be a very controversial topic, and eye care. And I actually read it, and it did help me with one of my insurance companies. For those of you that don't know what questions to ask your doctor's office, the book is actually really good. And it was one of those few times when I emailed him and I said, thanks for the large print. Because that put it right to the top. I mean, I have to thank Dr. Maxine Thompson, whose book I just read, L.A. Blues 2, which was really great. Thank you, Maxine, for the large print. That's probably why I read your book in an hour and gave you your 5 stars that you deserved anyway. But if you could choose one sense, and I know you say you like to write books with multidimensional senses, If you could choose one sense within this book or any book, which one would radiate the most in the death scene, in a crime scene? Which one? Which
in,
one
it,
sense?
It would be touch. A lot of the times, I don't say somebody thought this.
Mm-hmm.
I say they felt this. The verb to feel is a frequent one in my novels, and I try to use texture as much as I can, so that I want people to feel that they are within the scene. And then, of course, sound and you know, smell and taste, that all has something to do with touch, but 'cause sound is a touch. But the feel, that's a big deal for me in these books.
This was like, if I tell you, I can't wait to read the next one. You have to promise you're going to send it to me.
Oh, I'm happy to do. And let me just say quickly, MJ Rose, whom you're on having next week or having on next week, is a good friend, and I love her work, and it's very exciting that you're going to have her to talk to.
I'm excited too. I'm excited that I talked to you. I mean, actually, I have to say, like I said, my brother and my family, I'm the reader in the family, and the reason being, my mother made me read 10 books a week and take notes on them. That's probably why my book reviews are so. Yeah, she did. She believed that reading was, you know, was the key to everywhere, and it was the power, and you can actually escape into so many different worlds. And my other favorite book in the whole world dealing with opium is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I love that book.
Yes.
And Robert Louis Stevenson also was into that.
Yep.
When I taught it in school, I actually took a glass of red liquid and was cranberry juice, people, and drank it and acted out, you know, the changes in the drugs and whatever. And I'm little, so I had to get a pair of heels to stand on stilts to become Dr. Jekyll. And then, you know, shrink to become Mr. Hyde. And yeah, the time period is so interesting, and I want to thank you so very, very much. Can you tell everybody where they can learn more about you? By the way, my cousin bought your book on Kindle yesterday because I told
her. Oh, well, thank her or him.
Her.
You know, I hope that is it he or she?
Phyllis, I hope you got it. My cousin Phyllis loved it, and I know that my
Phyllis, I didn't get the name. I'm
hoping my brother-in-law was waiting for me to give him your copy of the book, but I'm not, because you signed it. He can't have it. Sorry.
Well, I hope they feel, you know, as I said, they feel they are truly there. And I forgot the question. What is it you asked me about?
Where can we find out more about you?
Oh, yes. My website is davidmorell.net. I couldn't get the com. There's a photographer named David Morell. So it's davidmorell.net, and it's sort of like a magazine. There's a lot of photos, and there's a lot of information, you know, people tell me it's kind of entertaining. Some of the pieces I hope interesting in the way that a magazine can be interesting. And I'm also on Facebook, but all that can be obtained. I'm on Facebook every day. I have a robust Facebook page. We talk about popular culture, about novels and books and movies and music and stuff like that. And a lot of people just drop in to, you know, for recommendations about what to read or what to watch. And that link is on the website as well. So if they're interested, it's davidmorell.net, and if they care, I think they'll learn a lot.
I hope so, and I would love for you, here's another little question. MJ Magazine is a magazine in memory of my sister, but it's a magazine for writers, readers, and authors. The second edition, I got an interview with Tess Gerrinson. This one with Laurie Foster and Robert Degoni, all of his books. I look for articles on how you create villains, writing tips for new authors, articles about main characters, issues of the time that you're writing in, or anything. So if you'd like to send one, that would be great. I'm doing this one.
Okay.
This one is going to be, and I'll publish your site, your links and everything in it, in the magazine. And this issue is going to be dedicated to the memory of Nelson Mandela. And we're going to do a whole bunch of articles on him and stuff like that. But basically, we're going to have my What's Your Opinion section. So those people that are listening, this month's What's Your Opinion is, should college athletes get paid to play basketball or play sports? And daylight savings time, do we really need it? And how much is too much homework for high school students? And those are
all
three of
questions.
My, yeah, those are my three. I'm the one that helps them. My nephews do homework all the time, so I know how much too much homework is. When you come home at 3 o'clock and you're sitting till midnight and you call your aunt at 11 to help you clarify, that's too much homework.
Mm,
so
that's too much
anyway,
homework.
I want to thank you so much. I'm on Facebook too, everybody.
Pleasure.
And I appreciate it. And I'm going to, when exactly is the next one coming out?
It comes out next March. It takes a long time to publish a physical book.
Yeah, I know. But thank you so very much. And I may enlist your services again when I do, in the fall, when I do Mystery Thursday, where I have new authors that like to ask New York Times bestselling authors questions about how they create a good mystery.
Okay. We can work it out.
Thank you, and thank you so much, David, and have a good night.
Thank you very much for having me. I very much enjoyed it.
You're welcome. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.